Just imagine a world where AI-driven healthcare solutions are just as commonplace as taking your blood pressure or reading your temperature, where technology can accurately diagnose illnesses, manage hospital workflows, and reduce medical errors. We're standing on the cusp of this healthcare revolution, and it's essential to address the challenges and ethical questions that come along with it. In this episode, I'm joined by Mark Nevin, a seasoned healthcare leader at EY, and Mitchell Berger, a distinguished director at Sydney Local Health District, who's actively researching the safe and equitable implementation of AI in public health. In this episode today, we explore the complexities of AI in healthcare, from standards and publications to workforce upskilling and clinical governance, the intricacies of AI development, the role of leaders in overseeing AI implementation, and the importance of trust and transparency in AI-driven solutions. Collaboration starts with a conversation, Team Health Tech. Let's make it happen. This is Talking Health Tech with me, Peter Birch, featuring content and community about technology in healthcare. Between now and the end of June, we're conducting the 2024 Talking Health Tech Audience Survey. This helps us prioritize content, hone in key messages, and refine the show to make it even better. We also want to understand who the biggest cohorts of our audience are. So I'd love for you to take 5 or 10 minutes to have your say and complete the survey. Everyone who completes it goes in the draw to win a share of $1,000 worth of THT Plus membership credits to put towards a membership for yourself as an individual or to help get the word out about your company. The link to complete the survey is in the show notes of this episode, or just go to talkinghealthtech.com/survey. Mitch and Mark, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thanks, Pete.
Good to have you on the show today. Thanks for making the time. It's great to have two different perspectives coming at a very topical discussion, which we're going to dive into now. But let's help set the scene a little bit more. I'll get you to introduce yourself. Mark, tell us about yourself.
Morning, Pete. So I am Mark Nevin. So I originally trained as a clinician, retrained as an economist, and specialized in public policy. I've worked in the space of health policy and strategy for many, many years, largely in sectors that are very reliant on medical imaging. So in the optometry sector, radiology, and radiation oncology, all three which are being revolutionized by AI. And I've been working in that space for, say, the last 4 to 5 years.
Got it. Excellent. And Mitch, what about yourself?
Hi, thanks, Pete. So Mitch Berger is my name. I'm Director of Strategy, Architecture, Innovation and Research at Sydney Local Health District. I work part-time there. I'm also doing a PhD in AI implementation at UNSW in the School of Population Health. And I've got an adjunct position at UCID in the discipline of digital health and biomedical informatics. So AI is a bit of a passion for me.
I was going to say, if we've got the both of you on this show for an episode, it would be disappointing if we didn't cover AI in healthcare. I think that's going to be a very central theme to this discussion, and not just to this discussion, but generally as well. AI in healthcare has been a topic that's always been interesting, but it feels like in 2023, it's really getting to the next level. Mark, you followed it through for quite a long time. There's a lot more attention on AI now.
No, look, absolutely. So it really initially started out with radiology sector and looking at the significant potential for analysis of images as well, and breaking down images and filtering those through algorithms, etc., and predicting what exactly is showing in those images, like looking at abnormal versus normal. There are multiple potential applications. So medical imaging and diagnosis is probably where it's gotten most traction over the last number of years, but there's a range of other even operational aspects like hospital workflow management, payer solutions, looking at quality and safety things as well, like medical error reduction, as well, the whole realm of precision medicine. AI is a critical enabler in respect of that. So yeah, AI looks like it's on the verge of going mainstream, which is very exciting.
Very exciting. It also brings new complexities, and well, not new complexities, brings complexities nonetheless. And in healthcare, in particular, ethics comes up often as the one thing to address when it comes to really embedding artificial intelligence in healthcare, right?
Look, absolutely. So I guess I've been working in this space for a number of years, and I think when considering the deployment of complex new technologies like AI, it's really time to look at, from an ethical perspective, the issues around safety, the potential for bias, and how that can influence decision making. Given the black box type nature of AI, complex questions can arise in respect of accountability, the workforce readiness to work and practice safely alongside AI. Like, what is, I guess, the transparency of some of those tools, and how can a clinician understand and interpret that and give, I guess, advice to a consumer, the patient, who's the key participant at the end of the day. It's going to bring new players into the healthcare space, like data scientists, and how are they going to incorporate within a team? So managing the risks that come up with that, there needs to be a solid governance framework overarching all of that to ensure that those risks are, I guess, thought about and managed in a systematic way.
Yeah. And, you know, Mitch as well, I can see you nodding along there, but, you know, even thinking, you know, we've always talked about in health about how we need transparency and no black boxes when it comes to artificial intelligence in healthcare. And that, if you're not really in it, you might know those words, but you don't exactly know what that means. And I think more recently, as more and more of us are being exposed to AI, everyone's playing with ChatGPT, you kind of put, for example, you put something into a tool like Outside of Health, and then it just gives you an answer. And you're like, thanks, that's good. That must be right then. So is that whole kind of black box mentality thing? Because in a fun little content creation way, that's a bit of fun. In healthcare, you kind of want to know where it's got that answer from.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think that for clinicians who are over time going to be increasingly relying on these sorts of technologies, that's a really important question, because they're used to, in their roles, being able to completely assure the information that goes into their decision making. You know, and AI poses a very different role, and it broadens the set of people within a district or within a health service who have accountability. You know, and I think it raises questions like whether it's appropriate for clinicians to have to assure the validity of those decisions that machines are making. You know, and you know, we're sort of just starting that journey, I think, in practice, trying to understand, well, how are we going to share accountability across decision-making systems? As Mark said, you know, it'll really sort of change our clinical governance and our insurance paradigms, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's right. We can't put this thing back, can we? So we're going to have to deal with AI, which is a good thing. It's not dealing with it in a bad way, but we need things around it to be able to use it effectively. So Mark, then is that where the standards and those guardrails come in to help put those things in practice?
Look, absolutely, absolutely. So I worked at the College of Radiologists for a number of years, and the radiology sector, I think, has been a leading light in this respect. So while I was at the college, I worked very closely with the board and the faculty councils and some of the senior clinicians and senior staff to really determine like how that sector ought to respond as well, and what levers it has to pull in order to do so. So we thought long and hard about where exactly we could influence. So we looked really at ethics, number one, as a leading body in radiology, and shaping the, I guess, how the technology would come to market via the ethics, but also look at the standards of practice as well in relation to deployment, some of the key critical guardrails. How does the workforce change up and upskill as well to practice safely alongside AI, as the entity which sets the training curriculum for radiologists and radiation oncologists? That was a key lever that the college had, but also the other components in relation to regulation as well, ensuring that AI is regulated appropriately under, at the minute, it's regulated under software as a medical device. But to breaking those down, I guess in turn. So in terms of like the standards, standards of practice are critical to really guide deployment and guide deployment at large scale, because it sets an industry best practice, and looking at what evidence is available, and then where there's no evidence, what consensus you can develop through the process of developing those standards. So in terms of standards, I think there's some critical components around. Firstly, standards to guide procurement of AI tools, which is really to look at the suitability of that AI tool for a particular patient cohort. Like in an Australian context, has it been exposed to data in relation to First Nations communities? So you really need to look at, from a standards perspective around procurement, to interrogate the data that the AI tool was trained and tested upon, and then to see whether those findings are transparent and explainable by human expert. I guess next component is really looking around workforce as well, and ascertaining whether your workforce needs to be trained and upskilled in respect of AI generally, but then the specific tool that's being deployed. So the workforce clinicians are working alongside it, understand the shortcomings of that technology and where and how they're going to give oversight in respect of that, and also communicate the findings from that technology to a patient. There's also a really important governance component as well in relation to standards. So clinical governance looks broadly at developing protective measures, i.e. safety measures, and productive measures, which are around continuous quality assurance. So clinical governance also takes responsibility for the upskilling of the staff and really determining where accountabilities would lie in respect of the technology. So what the clinicians are accountable for, what the hospital or practice group is accountable for, and whether there's any accountability for the AI supplier because of the black box nature of that tool. So standards of practice can really frame all of that and give then on an ongoing basis. So that's the initial deployment and then ongoing auditing and monitoring to see if the technology performs as expected. So in summary, then I guess they're the key guardrails that the standards can bring.
And as well, that brings trust, not just it brings, you know, the quality side and those elements that you mentioned too, but then this whole issue around trust and AI. If we can put, you know, trust comes from understanding generally, and people, while, you know, they don't need to understand, not everyone needs to understand the technical complexities of artificial intelligence and become coders, but people in health understand standards and the guardrails, and if there are those rules there, that gives us something to build from.
Yeah, no, exactly. I'm working in consulting these days, and a lot of the conversation I have in relation to AI are around that trust piece and the readiness piece. So there's trust from a procurement perspective. So trusting your health leaders that you've actually done your due diligence in respect of the technology so that you can deploy it safely. But even AI companies trying to engender trust in their technology around how it's been ethically developed. They've had medical or other input in relation to the development of that technology so that they've thought about the end user while it was being developed. So trust is critical in respect of these new technologies. Absolutely right, Pete.
The Talking Health Tech podcast has evolved a lot over the years, all based on audience feedback. Now I need your help. Yes, you, to shape the future of this show. Between now and the end of June, we're running our biggest campaign to date in order to understand what makes the global healthcare ecosystem tick. Last time we ran our Talking Health Tech audience survey, we learnt 40% of our audience are clinicians, 77% of our audience tune in for professional development and market awareness, 8% of people listen to Talking Health Tech for competitor profiling, and only 2% of people listen to the podcast to fall asleep. And this time around, I can't wait to find out about your preferences for audio versus video content, which topics we should dive into more, preferences for hosts and formats and geographical reach and so much more. And don't worry, we'll be sharing all the insights once all the responses are collected as well. So if you're a supporter of Talking Health Tech and you can spare 5 or 10 minutes, please complete our 2024 audience survey. And to say thanks for your input, everyone who completes the survey goes into the draw to win a share of $1,000 worth of credits towards THT Plus membership. Go to talkinghealthtech.com/survey or the links in the show notes of this episode as well.
You know, and Mitch, I see, you know, Mark's making some great points from, you know, from what he's seen and from the consulting side. Does it? I'm going to totally reword that and make me sound much more intelligent in post-production. So Mitch, the points that Mark's raised, you know, they make sense to me conceptually, but you're seeing things on the ground in the health district. Are these types of themes and topics and points resonating within Sydney Local Health District?
Yeah, absolutely. But you picked up on a good point, Pete. They're very theoretical, you know, I think 2019 was being referred to as peak AI principles. You know, there were thousands of ethical frameworks and best practices produced globally, you know, and I think the real issue for frontline health services is the gap between those technical standards and principles and actual practice, you know, and that,
find that which is the best of the best standard, you know.
Exactly. No. Literally, there have been there are frameworks that are assimilations of other frameworks. Yeah, right. It's just, you know, it's out of control, and the sort of, you know, the world's moving a little bit towards what would be called operationalization of principles, whatever that means. Yeah. You know, so, and it's not, you know, it's not unique to AI. Like in cyber, we've got well-established technical standards, you know, regulatory bodies, policies, and, you know, we're still pretty far off achieving those at reasonable levels of maturity. So it's going to be a big job over many years to build our institutional competencies in this. And, you know, to give you an example, Mark, your first point about, you know, ensuring that the systems we're using are not subject to discriminatory bias. You know, we've just taken a big project of ours through the relatively new New South Wales AI assurance framework process with the AI Review Board. And you know, their recommendations were really constructive and positive. And one of them was around assessing that the technology we're using, happens to be wound care, is suitable for our population. You know, which is completely legitimate, you know, and though it raises tensions for us in the district, because that product has got TGA approval. You know, it's been developed using an incredible amount of data from, it's a US-based product. And it's been the subject of two RCTs. So it's incredibly well validated from our point of view. The question is, how much responsibility does a frontline health service have to assure a technical product that's already been through regulatory approval? And so the utility of those regulatory processes is really, you know, we don't want to have to redo everything. You know, we want to be able to sort of buy and implement these products in the same way that providers, you know, suppliers who are trying to get their products used by health services to create benefit that AI offers, you know, they don't want to keep having to ask and answer the same questions. You know, so I think that's a real, like, tension point for health services. Yes, the assurance process is critical, of course it is, but at some point we want to be able to rely on the regulatory processes and say, point to them and say, well, this has got approval, we're just going to start using it and get the benefit.
Yeah, I mean, because we talk about regulation and how that, you know, in the innovation side, the creation of the technology, how you know, does governance slow down innovation and create, you know, barriers? But, you know, the counter argument is, well, lean into it and then that allows you to innovate and build the same goes for execution implementation too, though, is that if it can certainly fast track the execution and the implementation of some of these tools, but you don't have to continually redo the same work, as you say.
Mm. Yeah. And you're right, Pete. It is, you know, in that way, a robust regulatory process to approve these products for use is an incredible accelerator, you know, because if we might shepherd it in our district through the RCT process, but then other health services can rely on that experience and go for it, you know, like that's an incredible, it's incredibly important, the robustness of those regulatory processes.
I might add a couple of points there. So I think like the purpose of the regulation for medical devices is really to ascertain whether they're safe to place on the market for sale. So that doesn't determine that it's safe to be used in every context across a variety of different healthcare settings. Because in the delivery of healthcare, there's multiple different components and enablers in respect of when you're delivering healthcare. There's the software, there's also the hardware equipment that's used, there's a range of other medical devices and such, there's the workforce as well, the variety of different clinicians that are used. So you've got to think more broadly in respect of whether the AI tool is suitable. Just because it's been regulated and placed on the market, that doesn't mean that your workforce is already ready to go in respect of that. And I think for me, this is where clinical governance becomes really important around taking the fact that the tool is regulated, say, right, it's safe to place on the market, but is it suitable for use in our context? And the standards of practice and ethical guidelines, et cetera, yes, they are like a bit abstract as well in their application. So somebody needs to sit and think about, how do we apply that in the context of our own clinical setting? And then what upskilling do we need for our own workforce as well in respect of practicing safely alongside this technology. So that might be allied health professionals. It might also have a role for nursing. There might be a role for medical professionals as well in that respect. And thinking through who's going to be overseeing the technology as well and applying the findings of that technology in the and placing that in the context of an individual patient's characteristics and needs, desires, preference, et cetera. So there's a really important human element around how you apply these technologies, which is never going to be covered by the regulation piece.
Yeah, it's just, it's part of the puzzle. And, you know, I think you're right about clinical governance, Mark. I'll give you an example, Pete, if that's okay, from, you know, we've just about finished some research into remote monitoring and the viability of some of the devices which we want to use for automated detection of deterioration for remotely monitored patients. And so, you know, the sort of forerunner capability for real AI stuff. And, you know, that research has taken a long time, you know, a year to assess two devices, pulse oximeter and a temperature probe, you know, and like 12 months of work. And it's really robust, but what it's done is raised questions about the fitness for purpose of that data for driving automated decision making. You know, is it valid and reliable enough to drive truly automated decision making? Mm-hmm. You know, and that those devices are approved for use, you know, and then that raises the question, well, do we need to separately, independently conduct 12-month research projects on every device we want to use? You know, like, because there are 3,500 devices we could be using. You know, so these are really like for health services who are looking to try and implement these sorts of very complex models of care that embed use of AI, the how far you go on the assurance is a real question. You know, it's it's critical, and the assurance of that stream of data, whether it is fit for purpose, is a clinical governance question, you know.
To that point, the amount of time and effort involved in that assurance process, you know, the 12 months for something like that, it's not just annoying that it takes a long time. There's a cost associated with that too.
Exactly. And there's a cost for suppliers who are trying to get their products assured across multiple markets. You know, it's a real balance. You know, do they have to do an RCT in every jurisdiction? You know, like, are we going to accept, a bit like we do with the FDA, you know, extensions of an FDA approval process, essentially, within Australia? You know, these are really valid and still open questions, you know.
Yeah. You know, we've talked about some of the challenges of AI systems in, you know, in the real world. And, you know, something I think we were talking about earlier, Mitch, was this whole challenge. Like AI, there's one point around the diagnostic side, but, you know, particularly when it comes to the administrative side or efficiency gains, you know, there's a level of irony of implementing AI solutions to make a process faster, which was originally a problem caused by technology. So there's this kind of challenge of technology being implemented to reduce the burden of the technology. So are we, you know, do we run a risk of spiraling into this ever, you know, never fulfilling prophecy of technology to fix technology?
Unquestionably, you know, we're sort of, I do think there's an opportunity outside the sort of clinical, pure clinical applications to do robotic process automation a lot more in health than we currently do. You know, that those sort of really more corporate-y administrative applications are really where the technology is proven. But, you know, the RPA, the robotic process automation solutions we're looking at are sort of stitching together manual workflows that exist between existing IT systems,
yeah.
You know, which is really, you know, we're going to have an army of bots running around connecting our systems together, which is probably okay in the short term, but it feels, as you say, really ironic. You
know? Right. So, but there's challenges there for, you know, health leaders in different districts too, when they look at this, you know, insurmountable task of existing systems that are, you know, it's not just, you know, it'd be difficult to iterate up to a stage where it's really efficient and effective. I guess, you know, what have you learned in that process of, you know, is it all too hard and you put it, you know, you defer it? Are there little baby steps you can take to try and see some gains to give confidence? Hopefully, there's a light at the end of the tunnel for some of these health system leaders to implement some of these technologies.
Yeah. I mean, and it is really hard. Like we've put a lot of time into the sort of how we transition things from innovation and research land into production land, you know, and that crossing that chasm from research and innovation into production at scale is, you know, is for all the reasons we know, really, really difficult. But there are, you know, there are ways to do it. You know, I think people who know me well will, you know, laugh when I say this, but getting good at procurement is a really good way to do that, both on the supplier side and on, you know, well, I'm in government, on the government side. If you get your procurement process well done, you can make that transition really effectively. You know, if you're clear about what you're, you know, whether it's a proof of concept, whether it's a pilot project, whether it's an operational footprint, you know, for your system, you can really sort of streamline that process. And exactly as you say, you can start small with proofs of concept and then scale up. You know, there's lots of support, certainly in New South Wales Health where I work, there's lots of support to do that if you sort of can navigate the process as well. But that also takes time, you know, to get your head around, you know, the arcane policies and things that are often in the case in government.
Sure. So, Mark, we've talked a lot about systems, we've talked a lot about the technologies. You touched on a few times the responsibility of leaders in this space, of the people, but also the enabling the workforce. This is just as much a people challenge as a technology one, right, Mark?
Look, absolutely. So maybe just bring that down. If we start with the leaders first, like, at the end of the day, leaders in healthcare are taking these calculated risks all of the time around deployment of new technologies. And my advice to them would be to leverage the processes that you already have in respect of things like procurement. So you can start to look at the technical readiness for an AI tool for deployment, leveraging clinical governance capabilities, which exist across the board, just where the workforce upskilling is a particularly critical piece. And then we touched on a moment ago just around that whole accountability piece and people taking risks, but having these are essentially calculated risks, which you need to have a framework in place to look. You've analyzed the range of risks and you've got a method by which you're going to manage those. I think the workforce is going to be long-term the really interesting piece in respect of AI technology. So I've been doing some other work and research in the AI implications for the health workforce and looking at with the existing duties that healthcare professionals have in respect of keeping a pace with new technologies and new treatments, processes, et cetera, with healthcare. The requirement to do continuous professional development is based on that need and duty to stay current in respect of how you practice healthcare. And as AI becomes embedded into routine practice, first of all, in respect of specialties that are using medical imaging, but then elsewhere as well, that there is a duty and a requirement to upskill for sectors in which AI technologies are pretty advanced. There's certainly an expectation from the global peak bodies and I guess standards entities around the workforce must upskill in those areas. And surveys of I guess young medical specialists and medical specialist trainees have really shown and expressed a desire to upskill alongside AI. So the health workforce, I think the bar is going to raise in respect of the baseline knowledge that you need to have to practice safely in your area of medicine. And when AI comes into play in a particular specialty, they don't need to understand exactly the ins and outs of how the technology is developed, but they need to have a broad understanding of how the technology is developed, not detailed, but also to understand the risks and the oversight procedures and things that they're responsible for when they're making a decision based on an AI tool. So I think the entire workforce longer term needs to upskill and reach a new, I guess, threshold for that.
I'll give you a practical example.
Yeah.
Like we're doing some research in early stage implementation of AI image processing systems, you know, and the product we're using is approved under the software as a medical device framework, but under the exemption within the framework that it does not provide a diagnosis. It's providing a decision support. Mm. Now, the clinicians who are using that sort of system will have to know that the thing that looks like a diagnosis and sounds like a diagnosis is actually not a diagnosis. Mm. You know, and it's and so they can calibrate how much they rely on it. You know, and that's quite a, you know, and like another example, this one, we don't have anything to do, but the many listeners will be familiar with the Babylon symptom checker that was used in the UK. Mm. You know, the underlying system within that symptom checker was called the Babylon triage and diagnosis system. But the fine print about terms of use said it does not provide diagnosis. You know, and so, you know, if you're a clinician, like, is it providing a diagnosis or not? Mm. You know, and this, and if it's not, well, why are we paying for it? You know, that, and I think that's the sort of the knowledge. It's not necessarily the technical knowledge, but it's knowing to what extent can I rely on this? You know?
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. And therein lies one of the major challenges as well, because if you're using a technology that's right 70, 80% of the time as well, there's a risk of automation bias, which is back to the conversation earlier about ethics. So that automation bias basically means you're relying on technology that's right most of the time, and you basically fall into the trap of assuming that it's going to be right pretty much all of the time. You switch off some of your other kind of critical thinking as well, because the technology is right most of the time. So yeah, that's good enough as well. That's going to be correct. But in respect of healthcare, because of the relationship between the clinician and the patient and the service provider across that network, the clinician is responsible for the application of that AI in respect of an individual decision about a patient's diagnosis, treatment, management, whatever that might be. So the clinician is a regulated entity by the APRA structures within Australia. So at the end of the day, they're going to be responsible for if something goes wrong in respect of that patient, a large portion of the liability will rest with them. If there's something wrong with the technology and the black box nature of it, there may be some liability for the AI supplier in that respect, but there's also some overarching responsibility for, I guess, the organization, say the hospital, that decided to implement the technology in the first instance. But when it boils down to how it was used in respect of a particular patient, the clinician remains responsible for that.
Do you think, Mark, I mean, get your crystal ball out. Is that always going to be the case? You know, because I know, like, obviously the premise is individual accountability. But when you're using systems that you can't possibly expect clinicians to introspect into and understand and assure, because they can't assure the data pipeline, you know, they don't have time. Is it always going to be fair that they retain 100% accountability?
I don't think they will have 100% accountability, but I guess it depends on the instance that you're looking. So I worked in professional indemnity insurance for a number of years. You have to go quite forensically in terms of when something goes wrong to break down the different steps along the way and who took responsibility for the different components of that. So in respect of AI, I think the framework to think about is really around shared accountability and shared responsibility for the different components of that complexity. But it's really, really important to get everybody on the same page around the upfront before you deploy the technology. So the standards of practice that have been developed previously looks at breaking down and allocating those responsibilities across, I guess, the different actors that are involved. Because at the end of the day, Mitch, you're right, it's going to be a shared accountability piece. Although when it boils down to use with a particular patient and if something goes awry, it'll predominantly be the clinician for the foreseeable future, but there are aspects of shared accountability because somebody, I guess, higher up the management structure may have made a decision. Yes, we're going to adopt this technology across the hospital for all presentations that come in, but in respect of its use for an individual patient as well, that clinician-patient relationship is what's quite special in respect of healthcare as well, and I think will be at the forefront for the foreseeable future.
I think what you said there, Mark, too, and I think what we've kind of just covered for the past couple of minutes, encapsulates that whole wicked challenge of healthcare and technology innovation of the multiple stakeholders with different responsibilities and different accountabilities and different funding and one conflicts with the other. And then if we can see those those little steps forward of progression, it helps, you know, us break out of some of these points. You know, to close out some of this conversation, then, you know, I think the past 20 or 30 minutes or so has given this, you know, remarkably well-rounded overview around the opportunities with AI in health and the associated challenges and the way to address that. Any, for those heads who are swimming with potential opportunities and excitement, or even just working out what they do now with this information, any final thoughts or ways to close out this discussion? I might go with Mitch first and then Mark to close up. Mitch, any final thoughts?
No, thanks, Pete. I mean, as Mark's been saying, I mean, I think there are lots of pieces of the puzzle that, you know, in addition to regulation, I know I've talked a lot about that, but, you know, workforce is a big issue. And I also think that it'll be important for health services, you know, Mark, as you previously said, to think about, it's not a new thing. You know, health services are really, you know, they're in the business of innovation. They're in the business of adopting new technologies. AI is another technology. And so, you know, the existing governance processes, the existing frameworks we've got in place, our ethical principles, you know, are well established and strong. And so how we augment those and tinker with them and tweak them to facilitate the use of AI, you know, rather than having a whole new thing going on. You know, I think it's going to be a process of augmenting existing ways of working and existing processes that, you know, that'll facilitate the adoption of AI rather than having a completely new framework. And it's going to take, like, I think we should, it's going to take time is the other thing I would say. It's going to be a gradual process of building our institutional competencies across workforce and governance and understanding those, you know, how use of AI affects accountability equations and things like that. So, you know, they're the two points I'd finish on.
What about yourself, Mark?
Look, I think there are quite a few complexities to wade through in respect of AI. AI is starting to get deployed at significant scale, and the whole wealth of new applications as well that are coming downstream. I think it's important really for a healthcare organization to really focus on three different components. So look at technical readiness as well for the adoption of that, how the data is going to be managed, the quality of the data used to train it, etc. I'm a big proponent of clinical governance as well. So trying to bridge that gap between the ethics and the standards and what's actually going to happen at the clinical coalface and how the workforce is prepared to work safely alongside it as well. And figuring out some of those questions in respect of accountability as well, and looking at breaking down the responsibilities and making sure every party's clear on where their responsibilities lie and how they're going to manage those. And we've touched on the regulation piece. You can't really rely on the regulation alone to safely deploy AI in a healthcare setting. But as Mitch also touched on, you really got to leverage your existing capabilities and learn from the safe deployment that's already happened in other parts of healthcare.
I couldn't have put it better myself. Mitch, if you want a gig as a podcast host as well, you're welcome anytime. Look, I appreciate, like, but in all seriousness, what a great way to be able to you know, round out and understand these complexities and the challenges, but also the exciting opportunities of artificial intelligence and other technologies in healthcare. You're right in that it's going to take time, but hopefully through conversations like these, we can inch a little bit more forward and excite others to do the same. Mitch, Mark, I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for sticking around to the end of this episode. If you made it this far, you're the perfect person that I want to hear from. Our THT Plus audience survey is now open until the end of June, and I personally read every submission. In fact, if you leave a comment in the survey that you heard this promotion in a podcast episode, I promise I'll reply directly to you by email with a personal note of thanks, and I'll even buy you a coffee next time I see you in person. It's pretty easy. Just go to talkinghealthtech.com/survey and have your say.
For more content and community about technology and healthcare, visit talkinghealthtech.com.